I'm Kimberly Atkins, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Dmitry Alperovich is one of the nation's leading cybersecurity experts. He's investigated most of the major hacks of the past decade, including the attack on Google in 2010, blamed on China, and Russia's 2016 hack of Democratic National Committee emails. Back in 2014, he was chief technology officer of CrowdStrike, itself a big name in cybersecurity. One day, he got a call from a senior security executive at Sony Pictures in Hollywood.
I got a call on a Thanksgiving week, and they asked me to take a look at a file they were going to send me, a piece of malicious code they had just discovered on their network as they were getting going that morning. They wanted my opinion on what was taking place. And as I started looking at it, a few things became rapidly apparent. One, that this was a destructive piece of malware. It was actually attempting to take down and delete files across the Sony network and spread rapidly to other machines to cause as much damage as possible. But two, that it had some similarities to other code I had seen over the years from North Korea. Why would North Korea target Sony? In fact, in the past, they have not targeted the United States directly, either the government or the private sector. And why, of all places, would they target a movie studio? It just made little sense. So I kept digging. And then over the course of the next hour, I realized that this was very clearly North Koreans. I got more and more confident in the attribution as the code started to match previous code we have seen from the North Koreans, down to even a piece of code that had a typo in it in exactly the same way that it was in a previous attack they had launched against the South Koreans about a year earlier. So I called back my contact, a senior security executive at Sony, and said, "You're not going to believe this, but I actually think that this is North Korean malware. I can't understand why it would end up on your network." And he interrupted me mid-sentence and said, "No, I get exactly why this is happening," and proceeded to explain to me that at that point, Sony was releasing this movie called The Interview that was a comedy, but had an episode in there that was a successful assassination of Kim Jong-un, which the North Koreans had objected to.
Within an hour of that first call, Sony's network had been brought to a standstill. Sony asked Dmitry to go public to declare that North Korea was behind the attack.
And to my great surprise, there was a tremendous amount of pushback from the broader cybersecurity community who had not worked the case, who had not seen the malware or done any detailed analysis on what was taking place inside the Sony network, but who nevertheless proceeded to express very strong opinions publicly in the media and elsewhere that this could not possibly be a nation state. It had to be an insider of some sort with an axe to grind against Sony. Luckily for me, the U.S. government independently reached the same conclusion as we did.
President Obama vowed there would be consequences.
They caused a lot of damage. And we will respond. We will respond proportionally. And we'll respond in a place and time and manner that we choose.
6 years later, in December of 2020, an even bigger hack was detected in software distributed by a company called SolarWinds. That software was used by large corporations and government departments to manage their IT networks. Russian hackers had been prowling around thousands of government and private sector websites completely undetected for 9 months. So what lessons did we learn from that 2014 hack at Sony, and did we fail to apply those lessons in 2020? Do we need to rethink our approach to cybersecurity going forward? Joining me from Northern Virginia is Senator Angus King, an independent from Maine and co-chair of the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, which was established in 2019 to make this country less vulnerable to cyber attacks. Senator King, welcome to On Point.
Great to be with you, Kim. Important topic.
And also with us from Palo Alto, California, is Nicole Perlroth. She covers cybersecurity and espionage for the New York Times and is a guest lecturer at Stanford University. Nicole, thank you for being with us as well.
Thanks, Kim. It's a pleasure.
So I want to begin. President Biden announced sanctions and new appointments after the SolarWinds attack. as well as for the 2016 Russia hack on presidential elections. But Senator King, he said he could have gone further, but chose not to. What do you think about that approach? And are we where we need to be when it comes to cybersecurity?
Well, you've asked the ultimate question, and there are lots of answers to that. The short answer on the question of President Biden is at least he did something, and he did some significant sanctions, and I think that's incredibly important. One of the problems has been, and your piece about Sony sort of outlined it, is that we have been absorbing these cyber attacks for some years now without any real response. We've become a cheap date in cyberspace. And because of that, there's been no reason that our adversaries don't keep doing it. Why wouldn't they? It's relatively cheap. It's a way to really harm us very directly, and they haven't had any fear of consequences. So what the president did, I think, is important. I hope that it represents a turning point and the establishment of some level of deterrence. There are some subtleties to it, but the point is that if they're sitting around at the Kremlin deciding whether or not to come after a piece of U.S. infrastructure, I want somebody at the table to say, gee, boss, I don't know if we should do this because, you know, the United States is going to come back on us. They've told us, and they did it in the SolarWinds case. So that's something that I think is very important. Whether the sanctions are enough, whether there should be some other response, you know, that's a matter of discussion of national policy with the president. But the important principle is there was a response, it was substantial, and our adversaries are now on notice that we're not going to sit back and just take these attacks one after another.
So John Inglis, who sat on the Solarium Commission with Senator King, has been nominated to be the country's first national cyber director. CBS's Bill Whitaker asked him if Russia crossed the line with the SolarWinds attack.
In my view, yes. I think that espionage is generally recognized as being a legitimate activity of governments around the world. When you hold at risk the entire supply chain, in this case, could have been as many as 300,000 downstream customers. That's grossly disproportionate.
So, Senator, I want you to respond to that, but I also want you to explain what the Solarium Commission is for our listeners.
Well, it was created, I guess the background is that those of us on the Armed Services Committee, and I also serve on the Intelligence Committee, for years have been hearing about cyber attacks, cyber vulnerability, the difficulties that we have in responding. So the Armed Services Committee in 2019 created something called the National Cyberspace Solarium Commission, which was a totally nonpartisan group, very interesting makeup. Four sitting members of Congress, both parties. I'm an independent, but another Democrat, two Republicans. Four members from the executive and six members from the private sector. And I can tell you, we've had now 40 meetings. There's not a breath of partisanship. This is a totally bipartisan issue. And the whole idea was to develop, to take a fresh look at American cyber policy, because frankly, we really didn't have one. And so we worked for about a year, announced our findings in a report just about a year ago, March of 20, and then since then have been working with the Congress and first the Trump administration, now the Biden administration, on implementing 50-plus recommendations. One of the key ones you've alluded to, and that is the creation of a national cyber director, because the problem is and was that the responsibility for cyber is scattered all over the U.S. government, and there was no central coordination. There was no place where it all had to be come into some kind of clear focus. So the National Cyber Director is appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, in the executive office of the president, and that position has responsibility for coordinating cyber policy throughout the United States government, working with the National Security Council and the president. So that was, I'd say, our number one recommendation. It was passed in the National Defense Act in January, and the administration is now named Chris Inglis, who you just had a little clip from. And he's a brilliant, brilliant guy, a member of our commission, with an incredible experience in this area, to be the first national cyber director. And I congratulated him the other day, but I told him one of my principles of leadership is you want one throat to choke. You want somebody who's responsible. And I said, congratulations, Chris, you've now become the throat to choke in the United States government. So I think that's a big step forward. There's lots more to do, which we can discuss, but that was a positive development.
I want to get to Nicole here and ask what sort of what might retaliation look like. Jake Sullivan said that some retaliation will be visible and some invisible. Explain to our listeners what that means.
So we have had a policy over the past few years. It's been one that Paul Nakasone, the director of the NSA, has been a little bit more vocal about. And Senator King probably can't speak to this if he knows anything about what's being planned. But Jake Sullivan has said that our response to SolarWinds will have a seen component and an unseen component. And we just saw what the seen component was in the form of sanctions. The unseen component is likely or potentially to have a cyber attack or cyber element to it. So my colleague David Sanger and I reported a few years ago that the United States has been hacking into Russia's infrastructure, just like we have caught them hacking into our power grid, our utility companies over the years, almost as a show of digital mutually assured destruction. And I don't know what the response will be, but we certainly have the access to pull off a cyber attack that would create a real deterrent element to it.
All right, I'm going to ask our guests to hold right there. We're talking about how and why this country is still so vulnerable to cybersecurity hacks from other nations. When we come back, we'll talk about the ways in which society and the government and the private sector are exposed and what we need to do about it. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're talking about how the U.S. is vulnerable to cyber attacks and what the government is doing to stop them. My guests are Senator Angus King of Maine, who sits on the Senate Intelligence Committee and is co-chair of the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, and Nicole Perlroth, who covers cybersecurity for The New York Times. And Nicole, you were speaking when we went to break. I want you to finish your point and also explain a little more about this idea, as Senator King laid it out, about the U.S. being a cheap date when it comes to cybersecurity.
Yeah, you had been asking about what the potential response could be in terms of a cyber attack by the U.S. Some of the things that have been considered over the years actually aren't a cyber attack at all, but a data leak similar to the one Russia pulled off ahead of the 2016 election when they hacked John Podesta's emails and started dumping emails online. One of the options that I know has been discussed in previous administrations would be a hack of Vladimir Putin and Russian oligarchs that would expose levels of corruption. You know, so it doesn't necessarily have to be a cyber attack. Now, as far as the U.S. being a cheap date, I love that analogy. And I also agree. You know, our adversaries have been knocking on our digital doors now for more than a decade with increasing frequency. These attacks are coming from new corners of the globe. We are seeing the attacks out of China and Iran and Russia get increasingly more sophisticated. We have seen Russian attacks against Ukraine boomerang around the world and hit companies like Pfizer and Merck and FedEx and cost them hundreds of millions of dollars with little to deter them from then still coming back with solar winds and hitting our software supply chain. So I do think it's critical that we start imposing some cost on our adversaries. So like Senator King said, someone at the table is thinking twice before they hit the United States in that kind of operation.
I want to play a little sound from John Miller, who's a former hacker who develops cyber weapons for U.S. intelligence. He told CBS's 60 Minutes that SolarWinds was an act of cyber terrorism and that the goal was to frighten the U.S.
We're letting them do this, and there's no repercussions to them whatsoever. We haven't drawn a line and said, this is enough. You have to stop attacking us, or we are willing to escalate it. We're not willing to attack, and that's what we're missing now. There's no capability that the United States has that scares them enough to not attack us.
Senator King, you know, hearing that, saying that there is no capability or willingness by the U.S. To stand up against these sorts of attacks, it makes it seem like the U.S. has a dilemma, that it's very powerful, the most powerful nation on earth when it comes to offense, but we're so vulnerable when it comes to defense. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, before I answer your question, though, I want to focus on the word vulnerability, because I'm sure many of your listeners are saying, well, this is a government problem, cybersecurity, eyes glaze over. But the reality is we have sort of raced into the digital age without realizing what the vulnerabilities are. The financial system, everybody's money is online. Your bank account could disappear overnight. The electrical system could go down. We learned in Texas what that means. Water systems are vulnerable to cyber attacks. Telecommunications, everything could go dark. So the danger of this cannot be overestimated. Nicole has written a very powerful book about what this risk really is, and we as a country have not fully absorbed how dangerous this is. Now, my only disagreement with the clip that you played is we have the capability. The question is when and under what circumstances will we use it? And a deterrent is not a deterrent unless your adversary knows that it's something you can and will do. And that's really the theory. But the reason this deterrent idea is so important is we can never patch our way out of this. We can patch. We can use better cyber hygiene. We can do two-factor authentication. Quit clicking on phishing emails. We can do all those things. But ultimately, a smart adversary. And by the way, Brad Smith, the president of Microsoft, he believes that 1,000 Russian hackers were involved in that SolarWinds attack. It was very sophisticated. We're not going to be able to stop them entirely, and the only real way is what we've been talking about, is deterrence, that they realize something bad is going to happen to them. It's kind of, I hate to use the term mutually assured destruction, but it's let's call it mutually assured disruption. And that's the path that I hope that we've embarked upon as of last week. It remains to be seen. I think the administration needs to be clear and establish red lines and make some declaratory policies. We also need international attention to this. This should be worldwide. We need a worldwide international Geneva Convention of cyber, so that there are understandings about what is and isn't off limits and what will trigger worldwide sanctions as well as just from the U.S.
And you mentioned Nicole Perlroth's book. It's called This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, the Cyber Weapons Arms Race. We have an excerpt on it on onpointradio.org as well. So I want to turn to some of the priorities that John Inglis has outlined. One is reforming the U.S. government structure and organization for cyberspace. The other is to strengthen norms in non-military tools, something like a digital Geneva Convention. And another is to promote national resilience persistent engagement. Senator King, when you hear that, first of all, help us as lay people understand what these different areas are focusing on, and do you think that's the right approach?
Well, I think the approach is exactly right, and Chris English has been working on this for many years, and has experience both in the public and the private sector, and really knows what he's talking about. And he was an incredibly valuable member of our commission, and all of those things. A friend of mine in Maine said, "There's rarely a silver bullet; there's often silver buckshot." And what we mean by that is a multiplicity of responses, getting the U.S. government organized in a rational way to respond to something like solar winds is certainly important, and that's the place we started. Developing a deterrent strategy is important. One of our recommendations that hasn't been implemented yet, we're working on this year, is a Assistant Secretary of State for cyber to lead and get engaged in the international efforts to develop norms and standards so that if somebody crosses the line, they're going to be an international pariah. They're going to find sanctions from all the countries. I want these hackers to not be able to go to Monte Carlo or Paris as well as New York mm-hmm. or Miami. So those are some of the areas that I know that Chris English is going to be working on, and we're still working in Congress. I mean, I'm a U.S. senator, right? I could go on forever, but workforce is a big issue. Individual cyber hygiene is a big issue. And resilience, recovery, continuity of the economy. How do we come back from this? Mm-hmm. And the other issue that I know Nicole has looked at is we're moving into the Internet of Things, where your microwave talks to your refrigerator and they talk to your car and everything is connected, which is very convenient, but creates a whole new level of vulnerability. How do we know that our home router is secure, for example? So lots of different issues here, but the primary problem is for we as a nation to realize how serious this is.
Well, one of those issues is critical infrastructure, right? I mean, the Biden administration on Tuesday announced efforts to beef up cybersecurity in the nation's power grid after an unsuccessful cyber attack in Florida. Nicole, how can the U.S. respond to a potential attack when you know that there are hackers already eyeing the infrastructure? They're already really all over it.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. We saw an incredibly disturbing screenshot published out of the Department of Homeland Security a couple of years ago that showed Russian hackers almost literally with their fingers on the switches at a U.S. power plant. We know that they've hacked into the business networks at some of our nuclear plants. We know that basically they're inside these systems. They just haven't actually pulled the trigger to do serious harm. But what's difficult about SolarWinds is it's a tricky one. You know, I disagree with John Miller when you played that clip from CBS where he called it cyber terrorism. You know, this stops short of that. We've seen Russian hackers use the access that they have to turn off the lights in Ukraine, to decimate data, disrupt systems. In this case, the group that pulled off the SolarWinds attack was just attributed to the SVR. And Russia's SVR intelligence unit is really known more for being traditional espionage artists, really quiet prowlers. The problem is with the access that they have with the SolarWinds attack, they didn't just get into U.S. federal agencies. They did make their way into some utility companies. They could simply hand off that access to another Russian group that has been known for more destructive attacks. And so that is really the problem that the Biden administration faces when it considers what to do right now in terms of a cyber attack that would be part of the unseen part of the strategy I mentioned earlier. How do you respond to a cyber attack like this when you are not even confident that you have kicked your adversary out of your systems? And I think because these Russian hackers had more than 9 months inside these systems, inside these federal agency networks, it will be some time before they can confidently say that they've eradicated every last backdoor in their networks. And so that really creates a tough problem for this administration.
Yeah, so I appreciate your points disagreeing that the attack was terrorism. But can this get much more serious? I mean, is there a risk that these cyber attacks and counter attacks can end up into something bigger, even a war? I mean, Defense One reported that there is concern that from the Chinese that the U.S. will use cyber operations to target China's nuclear systems, and the United States worry that China might use its cyber attacks to disable America's nuclear advantage. Could this lead to war?
Well, just let's stick with the SolarWinds attack for 1 minute. You know,
yeah.
The SVR, the Russian intelligence unit I mentioned that is behind this, we know them pretty well, actually. We know that they broke into the State Department and White House networks back in 2014, 2015. And when I interviewed the people who were on the ground remediating that attack, what they told me was that when they caught them in these digital hallways, they didn't just scurry away. They basically stood their ground and reacted with the equivalent of hand-to-hand digital combat. It was really tough to get them out of their systems. At one point, the SVR's hackers even took over investigators' forensic tools and manipulated them so that investigators wouldn't find other Russian backdoors in their system. So that is who we're dealing with. They're extremely okay. sophisticated. They're hard to kick out, but they are not the Russian groups, other Russian groups that have shut off the power in Ukraine. Even so, the power for escalation here is incredibly serious.
I see. So, Senator King, I want you to talk a little bit about how previous administrations have tried to deal with this problem. In the last administration, John Bolton beefed up offensive capabilities, but eliminated the cybersecurity coordinator at NSC. Talk a little bit about how we got here.
Well, I think the elimination of that position was a huge mistake, and fortunately, in the new administration, one of the first things they did was appoint Ann Neuberger, who's very capable, very knowledgeable, to be the cyberspace coordinator in the National Security Council. She will now work with Chris Inglis as National Cyber Director. Again, you can't respond to assaults on your country if you don't have a Secretary of Defense. And that's really what we were lacking. We didn't have a kind of centralized ability to respond. But Nicole is absolutely right. The worry about SolarWinds does not appear to have been a destructive attack. They were looking for information. But the techniques that they used and the access that they gained could have easily been turned into a destructive attack. And you mentioned the possibility of escalation. There is a danger of escalation, and that's inherent in a deterrent kind of posture, because one side acts, the other side reacts, the other side then has an equal and further reaction, and it spirals upwards from there. But we're at a place, or have been in a place, and that's where I have some criticism for prior administrations, that there wasn't any reaction or not any significant reaction. So these folks just continued to come after us because it's cheap. And by the way, I want to mention an aspect of this that we haven't touched upon. We're talking about Russia and China and to some extent North Korea, perhaps Iran. But as the technology advances and our dependence upon their digital infrastructure increases, the other thing that really worries me is non-state actors. Is smaller, ISIS getting this capability or developing a cyber disruption cell to sort of take over some of the techniques that the Russians have developed. Then you're in a place where, how does deterrence work on a non-state actor? I mean, this is a very, very complicated problem that we've got to address on all fronts. Deterrence is part of it. International standards is part of it, and working on literally protecting our networks is the other thing. But as I said at the beginning, the most important thing is for the American people to realize we got a problem. We can solve pretty much any problem once we acknowledge it that it's a problem. And Nicole mm-hmm. mentioned, they can take out the electric grid. They did so in Ukraine. They proved it.
Senator, I'm going to pause you right there.
That's what we've got to worry about.
Senator, I'm going to pause you right there just so that we can take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about how we can build better cyber defense. I'm Kimberly Atkins, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. On Monday, we're kicking off our series on Amazon. We'll be talking about the Prime Effect, the ways Amazon is part of pretty much all of our lives, and what it means. We're starting off with a basic but complex question. What is Amazon? And we want to hear from you. Call and leave us a voicemail finishing this sentence. Amazon is at 617-353-0683. Today we're talking about why the United States, a nation with the most powerful capabilities in cyber warfare and cyber spying, is so vulnerable to attack. And we're going to talk about what measures the Biden administration is taking to build a better defensive capability. Still with us are Senator Angus King of Maine, co-chair of the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, and Nicole Perlroth, reporter for The New York Times and author of the new book, This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, The Cyber Weapons Arms Race. And we have an excerpt of that at onpointradio.org. Nicole, I want you to listen to this clip. General Paul Nakasone, director of the NSA and head of the U.S. Cyber Command, testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee last week, and he said the intelligence community is hamstrung in hunting down foreign hackers who work through computer systems inside the U.S. because they aren't allowed to spy inside the U.S. and because private companies don't always share information about what's being hacked with the government.
We have to understand that there are blind spots in our nation today. We are troubled in terms of being able to understand the depth and breadth of an intrusion based upon the fact that, for a number of good reasons, some of them obviously legal, that much of the private sector does not share this information readily.
So, Nicole, do U.S. laws limiting the amount that the U.S. can spy within the country, is that hamstringing our cybersecurity?
Yes, and General Nakasone is exactly right. What we've seen with the SolarWinds attack and then more recently a Chinese attack on some Microsoft systems is that our adversaries know that the NSA can't look at domestic traffic and get inside domestic servers. And so what they have been doing is they've staged their attack from inside the United States. The SolarWinds attack was staged from some GoDaddy servers in New Jersey. The NSA doesn't look at GoDaddy servers in New Jersey. Our adversaries know this, and they're increasingly using that to their advantage. So what do we do? Well, in Israel, they have made a trade-off here. They've said, we will allow Israeli military defense to come into corporate systems and domestic servers and monitor for intrusions and block them if need be in real time. We don't want that here. We don't want the NSA inside company systems, particularly companies like Microsoft and Apple that have to answer to foreign customers. And we had those debates after the Snowden leaks, and there's no appetite to invite the NSA into these systems. So what do we do? Well, what we're left with is a model where we need to partner, we being the US government, needs to partner with the private sector to share information about active attacks and cyber threats in real time. And we've discussed this for years, but no one has actually been able to put it into practice in a meaningful way. And that was part of the work that I know the Solarium Commission was focused on. And now it's become so critical with this active SolarWinds attack and then this latest Chinese attack on our systems.
So, Senator King, I want you to talk about that, particularly the vulnerability from inside the United States. It sounds like, in a way, the United States is sabotaging itself, making it harder for it to protect itself.
Well, Kim, this is an essential tension in our Constitution. The preamble says we have a responsibility, the government has a responsibility to provide for the common defense and ensure domestic tranquility. That's national security. On the other hand, we have the First and the Fourth Amendment, particularly the Fourth Amendment, which protects us against the government intruding into our private affairs without a warrant based upon reasonable cause. So that's a tension that we have. We don't want our government spying on Americans. On the other hand, as Nicole pointed out, our adversaries are pretty clever. So they'll run their attack through a server in the U.S. This is under very active discussion, how to balance the equities here. One possibility is, and I want to talk about the private sector in a moment, but one possibility is if the NSA sees suspicious activities abroad leading into American facilities, they can then report that to the FBI. The FBI does have the authority to investigate in the United States, going through a warrant process, which is part of our Fourth Amendment protection, but that's one option. But the important point here is that 85% of the target space for a cyber attack is in the private sector. And one of the things that we have to do is build a really unprecedented level of trust and cooperation and coordination between the private sector and the public sector. One of our recommendations in the Solarium is what we call a joint collaborative environment, a place where the private sector, with some protections, they have to be assured that they're not going to suffer some liability for sharing this information. But that's what's being negotiated and worked on in the Congress just right now, and to establish a place where the private sector can report without fear of repercussions in real time, and then you can have a coordinated response. But as I say, this is a whole new way to think about conflict. We think about armies against armies, battleships against battleships. In cyberspace, the attack surface is the private sector. It's the power grid, the telecommunications, the financial system. And so it requires a whole new way of thinking about conflict and how do you coordinate your response. And we have to reimagine conflict is really what we're talking about.
So, Senator King, where are the points of pushback to this idea, which I think is really important, about encouraging this collaborative environment between the government and the private sector?
There are a lot of folks whose red flags go up when they hear liability protection, when they hear that there will be some, for example, confidentiality of a company reporting the data. In my view, you've got to have trade-offs like that. A company isn't going to report data if they are going to see it in Nicole's column the next day, and it's going to, you know, their stock price is going to fall by 30%. So there have to be those levels of protection. But that's the fine-tuning that has to be done in the legislative process. How do you balance encouraging this kind of reporting without compromising the public's interest in information, but also in things like holding people liable if they're negligent?
Nicole, you talked about Israel and what is happening there. What other, from where else can the United States learn some lessons, possibly? What other highly digitized countries are managing to have access to that information, but while also having a really robust cybersecurity network?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I've looked at this, and there was actually a great study a few years ago that used semantic data that looked at the ratio of successful attacks on systems to the total number of attempts to get into those systems. And countries that performed really well in this data set were actually in Scandinavia. So I looked and at what does Scandinavia do differently than us? Because they are just as digitized as we are in some ways. You know, Nokia is based in Finland. Finland's the origin of Angry Birds. You know, this is not a country that is not wired up. So what do they do? Well, it's a couple of things. One is they have the strong cybersecurity policy in place that the Solarium Commission has been working to create over the past few years. They've had that in effect for, I think, almost 10 years now. And every year they take another look at it. They look at the threat landscape and they update it. There's also just a stronger culture of awareness there. It can sound lame, but cybersecurity awareness at companies is a mandatory part of their corporate culture. They have strict cybersecurity standards for critical infrastructure operators. And I think that they will even fine companies that are found to be lacking in things like two-factor authentication or are using older software. So that can be really instructive. You know, that policy has actually had an improved effect on the number of attacks that are successfully getting through their networks. Japan is another example. You know, they are also very digitized. And there was one year where they put in place a very strong cybersecurity directive that was remarkably specific in terms of mandatory standards for critical infrastructure operators. And the ratio of successful attacks went down significantly after Japan put that national cyber policy directive in place. So there is hope here. You know, when you think about the government coming up with a policy, it can sound like more bureaucracy and you sort of roll your eyes. But these other countries have actually been pretty instructive that this can have a serious effect. And I have to say that during the Trump administration, anything that was being done in the name of cybersecurity was really being done either at the kids' table, is how those efforts were being treated, or under cover of darkness, you know, especially when it came to election security. You know, the White House didn't want to hear about election security. We reported that a number of different ways at the Times. So what Chris Krebs and others at CISA were doing, they were really doing despite the administration's, you know, putting cybersecurity as a low priority. That is now flipped in the new administration. They have made cybersecurity a top priority. They have sort of been left holding the hot potato when it comes to the cyber threat landscape. They have no choice but to address these issues. And it just so happens that the timing works out because Senator King's and the Solarium Commission report is out there. We have created new leadership roles in the administration. We have tapped some of our best and brightest to fill these roles. So I think there is room for optimism. It's just that these are all things that we should have been doing years ago.
Nicole, I want to also ask you quickly, how much of a role does the private sector's own actions play in this, not coding well enough or secure enough to prevent these sort of attacks in the first place?
Yeah, it's such a good question. You know, I'm sitting here in Palo Alto, and what you hear from companies here still very much is what Mark Zuckerberg said 10 years ago, move fast and break things, keep shipping. Get your software to market or your app to market before the competition. Get as much market share as you can before the competition and you'll win and you can figure out all the security glitches later. That is what is happening. We are baking software into our lives at an accelerated rate, not just into our devices, but our smartphones, but into our pacemakers and our smart fridges and our autonomous vehicles and our traffic systems and our water treatment plants. And we're creating more vulnerable code. We're creating more vulnerable multiple code at a faster rate than we're sitting back and patching what's already out there. So it is critical that we create incentives for companies to slow down and practice security by design, bring in security engineers from the start to do sanity checks, to vet the code before they roll it out into these millions of systems and increasingly the Internet of Things. And we are really just at the very beginning of the age of virtualization and artificial intelligence. And we still haven't solved for security in the analog world, let alone, you know, this new wave of artificial intelligence and machine learning. So, you know, we have to figure out a way to incentivize companies to practice secure coding by design.
And Senator King, I want to end our discussion with you to say, well, what this isn't just something that America can do alone. We need international partners. What sort of efforts are we doing with our allies to combat cybersecurity?
Well, as I mentioned, I think there ought to be somebody, or we think there ought to be somebody at the State Department who gets up every single morning and thinks about this. One of the ways we're losing track of this is by not being fully participating in international conferences on things like what are the standards for 5G. If the Chinese are end up writing the standards, then they end up selling the equipment, and that's a whole separate problem. But there's another aspect of this that we really haven't touched on sufficiently, and that is this is an individual problem. This isn't the government's problem. It is the government's problem, but it's also our individual problem. The whole Hillary Clinton email hack started with John Podesta clicking on a phishing email. And we, you know, if people don't install patches that come out, I mean, the Microsoft Exchange China hack has been enhanced by companies that didn't install security patches that came from Microsoft from time to time. The individuals have to be individual citizens have to be responsible for this, as well as the companies. And the other piece, of course, that we haven't touched upon is disinformation, which is a huge problem, both within the country, but also coming from outside of the country. And education's the best answer for that. We have to be better consumers of information and know when people are trying to mislead us. And we have to be, you know, looking for a variety of sources and verifications of facts and those kinds of things. So we could do a whole program on disinformation. But yes. I agree with Nicole. The companies have to be more responsible. One of the things our commission suggested is a kind of underwriter's laboratory for cybersecurity. You know, when you buy a toaster, there's a little UL label that tells you it won't burn your house down. We need we're talking about a similar voluntary cybersecurity label on your home router, on your smart car, and I think that's a step in the right direction.
Well, Senator Angus King of Maine, co-chair of the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be with you. Thanks for the discussion. I really appreciate any time we can raise this point with the American people is important.
Thank you. And Nicole Perlroth is a cybersecurity reporter at the New York Times. Nicole, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, both of you. It really is music to my ears that we're talking about these issues in such a nuanced way, and that
thank you.
The first big step.
Thank you. You can continue this conversation and get our On Point podcast at onpointradio.org. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Meghna Chakrabarty will be back on Monday, and this is On Point.